This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Robin D.G. Kelly, has written a biography that has just come out in paperback. Its subject is the jazz composer and pianist Thelonious Monk, whose dissonant harmonies and angular rhythms have had a profound and lasting impact on jazz. Kelly says his research debunks several myths about Monk. For example, Monk often has been portrayed as eccentric, but Kelly says Monk actually suffered from bipolar disorder. Monk sometimes was portrayed as primitive, but Kelly says Monk possessed an impressive knowledge of and appreciation for Western classical music, gospel music, American popular songs, and art songs. Monk was born in 1917 and died in 1982. Kelly's book is based, in part, on conversations with Monk's surviving relatives, including his widow Nellie, who died while Kelly was researching the book. Kelly also had access to tapes of Monk's music and conversations made by Nellie and the photographer W. Eugene Smith. Robin Kelly is a professor of history and American studies at the University of Southern California. His book is called Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. Kelly spoke with Terry Gross last year. Let's start with Monk's first recording of his most famous composition, Round Midnight. This is a Blue Note recording from 1947.
That's Thelonious Monk at the piano playing his composition Round Midnight. This is his first recording of it from 1947. My guest is Robin Kelly, the author of a new biography of Monk. Robin D.G. Kelly, welcome to Fresh Air. So, Robin, tell us the story behind Round Midnight. How did Monk write it?
Sure. The song was originally called I Need You So. It's one of my great discoveries. And it was written with lyrics, and he worked with a friend of his who lived in the neighborhood, a woman named Thelma Elizabeth Murray, and she wrote these beautiful lyrics to the song. And it was a love song. It was his attempt to get a hit, because one of his goals was to get a hit. But he copyrighted the song in 1943. This is 4 years before he first recorded it. But he could not get his own recording. Eventually, Cootie Williams, a band leader, basically made the first recording of it. Bud Powell, who was a pianist himself, who was one of Monk's friends and hung out with Monk, convinced Cootie to record it, and Cootie added an interlude. And when he recorded it, which is typical of band leaders, he put his name on as a co-composer. And later, he found another lyricist, a man named Bernie Hannigan, and he put his name on as a co-composer. So in the end, not only did Monk not make the first recording, but from that point on, he became a third owner of the song. And to this day, the Monk estate only gets a third of the royalties as a result.
Monk invented his own piano style. How would you describe some of Monk's compositional and pianistic innovations?
Well, there are a few things. One, Monk loved dissonance. And by dissonance, it's those clashing intervals, you know. Sometimes he'll play like an F and F sharp at the same time. Now, on the one hand, that sounds like it's innovative and fresh and new, but a lot of these devices, the dissonance, the kind of off-meter playing, These are devices that he learned from the old stride pianists in Harlem, and people like James P. Johnson and Willie the Lion Smith. He just took it to a more exaggerated place.
Wait, when you say he learned from them personally, like watching them or listening to their records?
Well, personally, I mean, one of the things that amazes me about Monk's story, no one's really written about before my book, is the fact that he spent as much time hanging out with these old pianists in the late 30s and early 40s as he did with sort of the bebop young musicians. And so there's a great story that Billy Taylor tells in the book where, he ends up going to James P. Johnson's house. He doesn't realize where he is. And he's there, and all these piano players, a guy named Jippy and Clarence Prophet and Willie the Lion Smith, and there's, you know, young Thelonious Monk playing stride piano with everyone else. And these little parlors became really spaces for musicians to show off and teach each other and really just celebrate the instrument of the piano. And so Monk is very much rooted in these older traditions. And so he would take these old practices, even the bent notes that he played, and he'd take that from James P. Johnson and Willie the Lion and, you know, give it a kind of modern twist. And then the other thing about Monk is that, you know, he came up at a time when bebop is taking off and piano players use their left hand less frequently, whereas the old-fashioned players always use the left hand. Having a strong left hand was part of what made you a pianist. So Monk was able to retain that strong left hand, and when you listen to him play, his left hand had such great independence that if you just listen to the lower notes, they're very carefully placed. They're not just supporting the harmonies. They're rhythmically rich and fascinating, and they have their own kind of counter melodies. So he has a melody on the right and a melody on the left going at the same time.
Well, I want to play Trinkle Tinkle, which is one of Monk's compositions. And his left hand is so strong on this. You know, Max Roach is the drummer on this track, but it sounds like there's two drummers almost, you know.
Yes,
Monk's
exactly.
Left hand and Roach.
Exactly.
So say something about Trinkle Tinkle and this recording of it and what's special about it to you.
Yeah, well, Trinkle Tinkle is one of my favorites. Most people know the version he did with John Coltrane, but this is the first recording made in 1952. And Max Roach, as you mentioned, is a drummer. Gary Mapp is the bass player. And to me, it is an example of Monk's virtuosity as a piano player. And like you say, you know, his left and right hand, the independence of them both make the song. But he is able to, I think, restore the sort of old stride pianist's little tricks with his right hand. And he has this kind of rhythmic sensibility that's so strong and so powerful. He swings so hard that he's always on the beat. You know, even when he seems to be floating away from it, the beat's always there. And it's a very very difficult song to play, I'll put it that way.
And just one other thing, his runs are so great. And
yes,
so off kilter.
They are, definitely.
Okay, so this is Trinkle Tinkle. Recorded in 1952, Thelonious Monk.
Thank you.
That's Thelonious Monk's 1952 version of Trinkle Tinkle, his own composition. Robin, is that his first recording of it?
That's his first recording of it, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Max Roach was featured on drums. My guest is Robin D.G. Kelly, and he's written a new biography of Thelonious Monk called Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original. What was going on in Monk's life when he recorded Trinkle Tinkle in 1952?
Well, it was a very difficult time. Nellie, his wife, calls it the un-years, you know, U-N, un-years, because in 1951 in August, he had been arrested for possession of heroin. The short version of the story is that he was in a car with Bud Powell and two people he did not know. Bud Powell had a glassine envelope with heroin in it. When the police pulled up just to investigate the car sitting in front of Monk's house, Bud Powell threw the heroin in front of the car, and it landed at Monk's feet. They all were arrested, but it was Thelonious who served time. He ended up serving 60 days in Rikers Island in the workhouse, and he never did turn Bud Powell in, you know, which would be unusual if he did, but so he ended up taking the rap. What's interesting and probably worse than the jail sentence is that he lost his cabaret card, and in New York City, as a result of a law that was passed in 1940, everyone who worked in establishments that served alcohol because of the cabaret laws had to have a cabaret card. The police issued these cards, and they also took them away. And so because this was Thelonious' second conviction, he had been arrested for drug possession in 48, he lost his card indefinitely. And so from 1951 until the spring of 1957, he had no cabaret card. And that meant that, in theory, he could not work in places that served alcohol in New York. That's the bad news. The good news is that thanks to the outer boroughs, places like Brooklyn and the Bronx and black-owned clubs, Monk was able to find some work, but it wasn't enough to sustain his family. I mean, his wife worked constantly. He had a small son who was born December 49, and it was a real struggle then. And these recording sessions, few and far between, were one very small source of income.
Monk also had problems with his mental health. Were there signs of that early on? Later in life, it disabled him. Later in life, there were periods where he was just about catatonic. But in the early 50s, at the time of the recording we just heard, what was his mental health like then?
You know, that's a good question. I find evidence of bipolar disorder, you know, the manic depression, and these cycles of manic depression as early as the 1940s. These examples, the evidence always got portrayed as examples of Monk's eccentricities, you know, that he would be up for 2 or 3 days at a time and he'd crash, or he'd go from house to house looking for a piano. This became part of the story or the lore around Monk. But of course, no one knew about bipolar disorder in the 1940s and couldn't see it as a diagnosis. By the 50s, and around the time he made these recordings, he was pretty stable, but as the decade progressed, his cycles became more frequent and they got worse. And so 1957, late 56 actually, Christmas 56, he was hospitalized for the first time, taken to Bellevue Hospital after he got into a small fender bender with someone, and the police didn't know what to do with him, and he was sort of standing there uncommunicative. And he ended up spending about 3 weeks in Bellevue with no diagnosis. A couple of years later, he ends up at Grafton State Hospital in Massachusetts, and there he is diagnosed with depression, and they give him Thorazine. And the thing about Monk's experience with mental illness, the two things I try to establish in the book, one is that these incidents were episodic. You know, he wasn't constantly unraveling. They're just moments. In fact, they're almost seasonal when he would unravel. And he got, the second thing is that he got very bad medical care. And it's not, you know, race has something to do with it, but it's not just that. A lot of it has to do with the fact that the state of psychiatry just isn't where it is today. And so a lot of the diagnosis was sort of, you know, not clear. The medication was kind of problematic. Thorazine was the antipsychotic drug of choice, and it didn't help Monk at all in terms of handling these episodes.
One of the things Monk became known for that was considered a sign of his eccentricity is that sometimes on the bandstand or outside of the club, he would just start spinning around in circles. And, you know, some people say, oh, he was dancing. And now I know some people think of this as a sign of autistic behavior. And I wonder if you've thought about that at all.
I thought about it and rejected it.
Mm-hmm. Tell me why.
Only because Monk was very clear about dance. I mean, and he also wasn't the only musician who got up and danced, actually. You know, he was the one who was the most famous. But he loved to dance to his music, and he used dancing in various ways. One, to conduct the band. Ask any drummer, and they would say when Monk got up to dance, he actually would give you the accents that he wanted. He would basically show you and demonstrate what he wanted to do. And there's a wonderful moment during his rehearsal for his big band in 1959 when his French horn player, we know his brother Ah, couldn't get the rhythm right. So Monk takes a break, takes him to the corner, and he dances the whole part. He dances his part. And it's like all of a sudden it just clicked, and he understood exactly what he needed to do. They went back to the rehearsal, played it just fine. And then Monk does come out of a tradition of dancing. When he was a teenager, he was one of the hoofers. He was among the tap dancers in his neighborhood where everyone tap danced, you know. So I see the dancing as dancing.
Interesting. My guest is Robin D.G. Kelly, and he's written a new biography of Thelonious Monk, the great composer and pianist. I want to play another composition by Monk, and it's called Crepuscule with Nellie, and this was dedicated to his wife, Nellie, who did so much to help him through his life. What are some of the things she did to take care of him?
Well, you know, they knew each other since they were teenagers, really, and they grew up in the same neighborhood. So Nellie, you know, knew Monk very, very well, and in many ways, during the first early years of their lives, she worked. You know, she worked as a hotel elevator operator at the Hotel Taft. She worked with Chock-Full of Nuts. She had all these odd jobs to make it when Monk couldn't find work. She, you know, raised two children, but she spent a lot of time on the road with Thelonious, first as a road manager in some ways, traveling with him. She made sure he was ready, dressed, you know, always, you know, looking good. And later, when his health began to really fall apart, she took over a lot of the functions of the band. She would hire and fire musicians. She was, you know, making arrangements and dates. And she was basically doing everything until it got to be too much for her.
Tell us what's happening musically in this and what you'd like us to listen for.
This was Thelonious's only what's called through composed composition, meaning that there is no improvising. It is Monk's concerto, if you will. And in some ways it speaks for itself, but he wrote it very, very carefully and very deliberately and really struggled to make it sound the way it sounds, you know, but it was his love song for Nellie.
Okay, let's hear it. This is Crepuscule with Nellie, recorded in 1957, Thelonious Monk. There's another woman very important in Monk's life, the Baroness Panonica de Königswarter, and she was actually a Rothschild. De Königswarter was her husband's name. So she was a Rothschild. She had pedigree and had more money than Monk did. They met in Paris when Monk was performing there. And she moved to New York. They became very close. She helped take care of him. He lived with her during the last years of his life. Tell us a little bit about the nature of their relationship.
Sure. As you said, they met in 54. they became very close friends, and it's very important to establish that she also became close friends with Nellie. And this is something I've been trying to say for a long time. It's almost like a lot of people don't hear this part. All three of them were friends. She was as close to Nellie as she was as close to Monk.
Are you saying a lot of people thought, well, Nika and the Baroness was called Nika Panonica, right. Nika short for that. So you're saying that a lot of people thought that Nika and Monk's relationship was probably more than platonic, and that Nellie right. must have been angry about it, but that wasn't the case.
That wasn't the case. I mean, the rumors that they had a romantic relationship, or the other rumor is that that Nellie and Nika competed, and it's not the case at all. They both worked together in Thelonious's interests, and you know, she was like an aunt to the kids, and like a sister-in-law to Nellie in some ways, and she. She was very, very important at certain moments in Monk's life when he needed help, when he needed to get his cabaret card back, for example.
And, you know, something else that Nika did for Monk during a period when he didn't have a piano, she got a piano at her place and he could come over and play there.
Yes, yes.
And during the last few years of his life, he lived with her. And this is a kind of, you know, mysterious thing. He's married to Nellie, but he's living with Nika. How come?
Well, in 1973, it was clear that, you know, she couldn't take care of him. His condition had worsened. He had been hospitalized again. And so everyone decided it would make more sense for him to live in the house in Weehawken, New Jersey. The important part of the story is that Nellie came over just about every day on the bus. She'd cook for him. She'd take care of him. He had his own floor. He had the second floor of the house. So she was still very much his wife, and Nika basically had the space and resources to make sure he was well cared for during those last years.
Well, let's get back to some music. Mm-hmm. You've chosen some things for us to hear, and the next one is Monk's version of Nice Work If You Can Get It, the Gershwin song, and this is from 1964. I love Monk's recordings of pop songs, because he reworks them. Like, you can tell he loves the melody. You can
yes.
tell he loves old songs. Not that this one was that old, but he recorded older ones, too. But you can tell he loves the song, and yet he reworks it. He changes the harmonies and alters the rhythms. Talk to us about his version of Nice Work and why you chose it.
Well, Nice Work is a song that's been in his repertoire since the 40s. And he loves it because he loves Gershwin's sort of use of certain sonorities. You know, for the technical people, it's the flat ninth. But it's a certain sound that Monk loved. And he loved the fact that the harmonies moved in chromatic, descending ways. And it just matched his own compositional sense. And what's interesting about Monk and these old standards is that he didn't stray too far. I mean, he put his own imprint on it, but he would play on the elements that are already there. And he just loved, and Gershwin's a great songwriter.
All right, so this is Thelonious Monk's 1964 recording of Nice Work If You Can Get It.
Thank you.
That's Monk playing Gershwin's Nice Work If You Can Get It, recorded in 1964. My guest, Robin D.G. Kelly, has written a new biography of Thelonious Monk. What was going on in Monk's life when he recorded that?
Well, 64 was, in some ways, Monk's year. He was on the cover of Time magazine, you know, in February of 64.
What was he doing on the cover? What was the angle?
Well, the short version of the story is that Barry Farrell, who wrote the cover story, wanted to write about jazz musician. And almost by default, Monk was chosen because they thought Ray Charles and Miles Davis was too controversial. So Monk was chosen. I know it's funny, huh? When you think about it. Monk was chosen, and the article became a story about Monk's weirdness, eccentricities, and his drug use, you know, on one hand, and on the other hand, it became a story about Monk not being so weird, because in fact, in this day when black jazz musicians seem to be more militant and complaining and whining about racism, Monk had no complaints, that Monk, in fact, was the safer bet, you know, because he wasn't so political, you know, in his, and of course, I challenged that, but still, in some ways, the cover story was a way of kind of presenting a more tame Monk while still presenting him as the eccentric genius.
Robin D.G. Kelly, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Author Robin Kelly speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. His biography, Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original, is now out in paperback. Our next guests collaborated on Winter's Bone, a film that won the Grand Jury Prize for Drama at the Sundance Film Festival. It's winding up on a lot of end-of-year top 10 lists, and it tops the Best of 2010 list of our own film critic, David Edelstein. Our guests are Deborah Granick, the director of Winter's Bone, and Daniel Woodrell, the author of the book on which the movie is based. Terry spoke with them earlier this year. Winter's Bone is set in the Ozarks, in a poor community where people have turned to cooking meth to make a living. The main character, Ree Dolly, played by Jennifer Lawrence, is a 17-year-old girl. She's taking care of her two young siblings because her mother is mentally ill and her father, who cooks meth, has gone missing. After being arrested and putting up the family home for his bail bond, he disappears. Unless Ree finds him, she will lose the family's home and have nowhere to go. To find out where her father might be, she goes to the homes of relatives and other people her father knows, most of whom are also in the meth business. They're not interested in talking. In this scene, Ree is looking for Thump Milton, the leader of this meth underworld. As she approaches Thump's house, she's met by his wife, played by Dale Dickey.
You got the wrong place, I expect. Who might you be?
I'm Ree. My dad's Jessup Dolly.
You ain't here for trouble, are you?
No, ma'am.
Because one of my nephews is Buster Leroy, and didn't he shoot your daddy one time?
Yes. That ain't got nothing to do with me. They settled that themselves, I think.
Shooting him likely settled it. What is it you want?
I got a real bad need to talk with Thump.
And he ain't got no need to talk to you.
But I need to. I really, really got to, ma'am, please. Some of our blood at least is the same. Ain't that supposed to mean something? Isn't that what is always said?
Ain't you got no men could do this?
No, ma'am, I don't.
You go wait in the yard somewhere by that coop, and I'll tell Thump you're here.
That's a scene from Winter's Bone, the movie adaptation by Deborah Granick of Daniel Woodrell's novel. Deborah Granick, Daniel Woodrell, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, the man that Ree, the character in that scene, is trying to see, Thump, Daniel Woodrell, in your novel, Winter's Bone, you describe him as having a face that's a monument of Ozark stone, with juts and angles and cold-shaded parts the sun never touched. His voice held raised hammers and long shadows. It's a man I don't want to meet. Now that we heard a scene from the film, Daniel Woodrell, let me ask you to do a short reading from the book that the movie's adapted from. And this is another scene in which Rhea's trying to find out what happened to her father now that he's skipped bail. And in this scene, she goes to see her father's brother. Would you read that scene for us?
Sure. What's this all about, anyhow? I got to find Dad and make sure he shows in court. That's a man's personal choice, little girl. That's not something you ought to be butting your smarty nose into. Show or don't show, that choice is up to the one that's going to jail to make, not you. Uncle Teardrop was Jessup's elder and had been a crank chef longer, but he'd had a lab go wrong and it had eaten the left ear off his head, burned a savage, melted scar down his neck to the middle of his back. There wasn't enough ear nub remaining to hang sunglasses on. The hair around the ear was gone too, and the scar on his neck showed above his collar. Three blue teardrops done in jailhouse ink fell in a row from the corner of the eye on his scarred side. Folks said the teardrops meant he'd three times done grisly prison deeds that needed doing but didn't need to be gabbed about. They said the teardrops told you everything you had to know about the man, and the lost ear just repeated it. He generally tried to sit with his melted side to the wall.
That's Daniel Woodrell reading from his novel Winter's Bone, which is adapted to the new film of the same name by Deborah Granick. Daniel, what are some of the things you most wanted Deborah to know about your area that you drew on for the novel and you felt that she needed to understand?
Well, it's been a way of life for a long time. To me, the Ozarks was more or less settled by people who largely wanted to be left alone originally. And there's still just a strong thread of that running through a lot of the people who've been here a while, this sense of privacy and don't ask too many questions about other people's business. And there's so much physical beauty, and yet it's always been difficult to make a living in the Ozarks. So there's a lot of the attendant poverty that goes along with that, and yet it's in such a beautiful setting that I really wanted her to appreciate that.
Deborah, what struck you most that you hadn't seen before?
I feel like I hadn't seen a variety of hand-built houses. That was not familiar to me, or houses that may have had one part built from another form of housing, be it a form of trailer or a kit house, and then additions or small add-ons very much built as needed or as could be afforded. So the texture of people's homes were extremely rich and diverse.
Did you decide to shoot in actual homes?
We did choose to shoot in actual homes. It would have been very difficult feat and probably with very little fruit to like imitate those homes or build a set that replicates it. Instead, we did come to believe that the only way that we would get the film just jammed with visual detail that was very precise and very much from those coordinates where we were filming was to actually go the full tilt and say, could we over time gain access to collaborate with certain families and then work on their properties, film, and that in the end meant like basically from A to Z. It was people's vehicles, their clothing, objects in their home.
Daniel Woodrell, the missing father in your novel, Winter's Bone, cooks crank, and everyone in the extended family seems to be involved in the business. Why did you want to write about characters who cook and sell meth?
Well, it's been a pretty widespread issue around here for the last 15 or 20 years, I suppose. And from my own house, I could throw a rock and hit meth cook right now. And it's just pretty ingrained, and it's a way to make some quick, easy money. You don't really have to be a master scientist to cook it or anything. And you can turn a quick profit. And at one point, we had a number of people nearby who were engaged. And when they've been using crank for a few days in a row, you don't know what they might do. So, and all manner of things did happen.
Like what?
Well, broad daylight violence. I used to have a neighbor who'd chase his girlfriend, wife with a table leg after he'd been up too long, and
broad daylight down the middle of the road, and things like that were happening, petty crime.
So when you saw your neighbor chase his wife with a leg of a table, did you call the police or just let them do their thing? Yeah.
My wife won't let me just stand there if somebody's going after his wife like that. So at one point in like 2 years, we had six domestics that were so close to our front door, we felt required to be the ones to go out and break it up. And that was all happening then, and it hasn't happened again now in some years. So all associated with the burgeoning of meth in the neighborhood.
Deborah, your previous movie was about a woman who's a coke addict. She was played by Vera Farmiga, and she's the mother of two, just as in your new movie, Ree is the older sister of two children, and she's basically bringing them up on her own. So it's that combination of taking care of children and drugs that hold these two movies together, that and the fact that the word bone is in the title of both of them. So tell us why stories where drugs have an impact on a woman taking care of children are stories that you want to tell.
In these situations, the stakes are just so high when drug use is an issue and children are present, so that the behaviors of a female who is responsible for children, it's just the pressures to do the right thing are even higher. The responsibilities are even higher. And I think that part of what fuels Ree in Daniel's novel is that Chief does feel the stakes are high for her. It's not just whether she could go out and sort of make her way and escape a bad situation, but that she does feel that she has these two young people that are very much tied to her. Their well-being is completely tied to her. And so I feel like in any novel or film, that responsibility, that existential responsibility, if you will, raises the stakes of what that protagonist is going to do, what choices she will make, what moves she'll make.
Daniel Woodrell, in Esquire magazine in 2007, in the Esquire 100 issue, you were number 63, and your entry was written by Benjamin Percy. And I want to quote what he had to say about your novels. He said, "Pick one up and you'll find blood and hay, barbed wire and whiskey, a Ziploc bag of crank. You'll find barroom brawls and trailer park meth labs, guns, a stripper with peroxide blonde hair. These are books for men." I think that's kind of funny, since Deborah, you adapted one of his books into a movie and really related to the fact that it had a strong woman character. So, Daniel Woodrell, is Ree an unusual character for you? Is it unusual for you to be telling a story from a woman's point of view?
Well, in a way, she's sort of the culmination of, or an elaboration on some female characters I've kind of written about all along, usually in smaller roles. But I think I've always included a lot of women in my books, and they're usually pretty potent women. But in this instance, she just was clearly the straw that stirred everything here. And once I started writing on it, she became more and more prominent, and I realized it was basically going to be all her.
I don't want to give away too much of the movie, so I'll just say here that there is a scene where a couple of women beat up another woman. And then a man basically wants to know, like, did a man hit her? And so one of the women says, this is how she says it in the movie, she says, "No man hit her, I put the hurt on her." And then in the book, the way she says it is, "No man here touched that crazy girl, I drubbed her good myself." So there seems to be almost a code here that, like, bad for a man to hit a woman, okay for a woman to hit a woman. Daniel, is that the code?
Well, I wouldn't say it's code, but I think there might be some ancient perception that that's a fair fight.
Right, right. Is that why you did it that way?
Yes, yes. And I have seen a few women brawls that were every bit as nasty as anything I've seen men do, so it definitely happens.
Where did you witness them?
Just in different establishments around my life and places, and one was in the Ramada Inn parking lot, actually one of the most savage I ever saw in broad daylight.
What happened?
A finger got bit off.
And, whoa!
Yeah, and she spit it at the other woman's foot, and I thought, I haven't even seen guys do that.
Wow, that sounds...
Well, they were serious.
Sounds like she had some pretty sharp teeth, among other things.
Yeah, she did. She must have had to break it and gnaw a little to get it off.
Daniel, I'm going to ask you to read another page from your novel, Winter's Bone. And in this paragraph, read Dolly, your main character, the 17-year-old who's taking care of her two young siblings, is thinking about and worrying about her siblings' future.
Ree's grand hope was that these boys would not be dead to wander by age 12, dulled to life, empty of kindness, boiling with mean. So many Dolly kids were that way, ruined before they had chin hair, groomed to live outside square law and abide by the remorseless, blood-soaked commandments that governed lives led outside square law. There were 200 Dollies living within 30 miles of this valley. Some lived square lives, many did not, but even the square-living Dollies were Dollies at heart and might be helpful kin in a pinch. The rough Dollies were plenty peppery and hard-boiled toward one another, but were unleashed hell on enemies, scornful of town law and town ways, clinging to their own.
So in your novel, Winter's Bone, Ree, the main character, is considering joining the military. You were in the Marines. Why did you enlist?
I was getting in just a little bit of mischief, and it seemed like the military would be a good idea all the way around. So I went in the week I turned 17, and both my parents thought it was a good idea, so it removed me from the scene for a while.
Yeah, but it sounds like it didn't work out the way you expected.
No, there was trouble to be found there as well, and as my father so often said, I found it. So,
when did you start to write? I presume it was after you got out of the Marines?
That's when I began to more seriously investigate it. I was always attracted to the idea. I always loved books, and my mother made sure I knew how to read before I went off to school, and I knew pretty early on that I'd like to be a writer if it was possible. It really wasn't until my early 20s that I really decided to dedicate myself to it full tilt and see if, in fact, you had the ability to do it.
How did you figure out what you were going to write about?
For a long time, I wrote stories about working-class life, and I had a professor say, you know, that's always going to be hard when you just do straightforward kind of kitchen sink realism. And as I let that sink in for a couple of years, I began to realize there were other kinds of fiction I also liked that could almost blend. They almost they complemented each other, really.
Who are you thinking
social,
of?
Well, social realist fiction and crime fiction have a nice overlap. So I was turned on by all the writers in the canon, but I was also always turned on by James M. Cain and Chandler and Thompson and all the others.
A lot of book critics in their reviews have mentioned that you should be better known than you are. It's kind of like a common refrain about you.
Yes.
I'm sure you've heard that song sung a lot. So, you know, it often works that once a movie's made, if it's adapted from a book, the author of that book becomes a lot better known. Are you hoping for that with this movie?
I think it's unavoidable now, so I've decided to hope for it.
Well, I hope you get it.
Right. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Deborah Granick, congratulations on your new film, Winter's Bone, which is adapted from my other guest, Daniel Woodrell's novel of the same name. Thanks very much to you both.
Oh, thank you so much. Enjoyed
it. Thank
you.
Filmmaker Deborah Granick and author Daniel Woodrell speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. She directed the movie version of his book, Winter's Bone, and the film is landing on several end-of-year top 10 lists. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.